history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories waiting to be told. There are seemingly ordinary Americans with extraordinary experiences, and each week we get the privilege of meeting them. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. General term applied to anyone who was on the island of Oahu on December 7th, 1941, which includes Hickam Field, and that's where today's guest Ed Hall was 75 years ago. But Ed, let's talk about before you went out to the islands, because that's a long way from where you grew up. Now, I want to get this straight. You were born in Greenville, South Carolina, and but you grew up in Greenwood, South Carolina? And isn't there a Greenburg somewhere in there, too?
No, there's a Greensboro, North Carolina. It's the only one I know.
That's true. Greensboro, for sure. So what was life like as a kid growing up in South Carolina? What do you remember about those days?
Mostly, I remember I had to work my little butt off because our family was rather poor. And although we did not live on a farm, where we lived, there was practically no zoning laws whatsoever. We had a cow and chickens in the backyard. At one time, we had a mule because my dad had 38 acres of land about 3 miles out of the city limits. As a kid, I had quite a few chores. We didn't have grass in the backyard. It was all dirt. We had pecan trees, peach trees, apple trees. And, of course, in the fall when those leaves all fell, that was my job. Clean them up. Harvest the pecans. Harvest the fruit. And my sister, she had to take care of the chickens and milk the cow. And Dad ran a bread truck. He sold bread and cakes to the different stores around town. And my job, after he came from the railroad station every morning with a fresh load of products, I was 9 years old, and I had to unload the truck. The boxes weighed about 20, 25 pounds. And then I had to unload and stock everything in the garage, take an inventory, and then reload the truck the way he wanted every item situated. And lo and behold, if I got one item mislocated, it was my little butt. So that was about my childhood until I was 16 years old. And I flunked out of high school, and I joined the service.
Well, it sounds like you had that military discipline at home a long time before you ever wore a uniform. And I've got to ask you, in those years, as you're working so hard and following all these rules and doing all this hard work, did you have some ambitions? Did you have some dreams of, hey, someday I'm going to do X, Y, Z?
No, not really. I was always concentrating, trying to keep out of trouble so my dad wouldn't be beating up on my little rear end. I was a mischievous child, I must say. And I did get in a lot of trouble, and I did deserve a lot of the lickings I got. But there were some that I didn't deserve, too, because Dad was a strict disciplinarian, very much so.
And you mentioned dropping out of high school and joining the service, but you weren't old enough to get in the service.
Well, of course, I had to lie about my age. My parents did sign for me, so I was allowed to go in.
So your parents went along with the lie? They said you were 17 when you were 16? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
So it sounds like the feeling was mutual. They were ready for you to take off somewhere too, huh?
Well, yes and then no. Then my mother told me later when I came home, your dad was very depressed after you left. A month or so after you left, he went in kind of a depression, and it took him a little while to get out of it. Then when I came home, he was glad to see me.
And we're going to hear about the day the war started. But before that, you must have been living the dream. Here you go from all this hard work in South Carolina. You join the Army and they send you out to this beautiful paradise called Oahu. What was that adjustment like for you?
Oh, let me tell you, that was great. When we arrived in Hawaii, I was stationed downtown at Fort Armstrong. It was a quartermaster base. We issued all supplies to all the different Army posts around Oahu. And, of course, that was a lot of work, but that was pleasurable. You know, you were working to accomplish something and support your whole Army, so to speak. And I felt rather proud being a part of that. And, of course, that was in peacetime, and promotions were very slow in coming. As a matter of fact, I never got one till I transferred out to Hickam Fields a year or so later. But I enjoyed being downtown Honolulu and about a 25-minute walk from Waikiki Beach. And I mean, it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people would be curious to know what that was like, because 75 years later, of course, we know Waikiki Beach and all of Honolulu and how urbanized it is and how tourist-driven it is. But back in 1941, how different was it?
Well, it was very different, because in Waikiki Beach, they only had two principal hotels on the beach, Royal Hawaiian and the Moana Hotel. And they used to do a radio show on the beach at the Moana Hotel under the big banyan tree. It was a huge, huge banyan tree. I don't remember the radio announcer's name, but Hawaii Calls was the name of the program every Saturday afternoon. That was a pleasure to be there if you were off that day and you could get there. That was a lot of fun. But we had a lot of fun all over that island. We had beaches on the other side. My favorite beach was at Makapu Point.
So was that a pretty carefree life, would you say, before the war? Did you have any idea that anything like this was coming?
Oh, of course not. We were living the life of ease and pleasure and joy. It was, I just can't tell you how beautiful and how wonderful it was to be in Hawaii before the war started.
And I guess, I know it's a cliche, but I've got to ask you, did the kid from South Carolina learn how to surf on Waikiki Beach?
No, I tried it once and I got my chest all skinned up and I said, nah, I don't think I want to do this anymore.
You didn't want the wahine to see those scars on your chest, huh?
No, but I'll tell you one thing we used to do. The surf out at the beach at Makapu Point, those waves would come in 8 and 10 feet high at times, and we had one heck of a wind out there. So we couldn't afford surfboards. They were too expensive. They cost, what, $10? I don't remember. But anyway, we used to take mattress covers. Now, some people don't know what a mattress cover in the Army is. It was a big bag, and your mattress went inside the bag. But we used to take those bags out to the beach, hold them up to the wind, fill them up with air, and tie it down real quick, and then swim out 50 or a couple of hundred feet, catch a wave and come flying in, laying across that mattress cover. And we were like, ski? And here again, I hit that sand one day, got all bruised up again.
Now that sounds like a reenactment I'd like to see someday. There's a lot of things people reenact from that time in history. I don't think I've ever seen that. Would you be up for it?
Today, at my age, are you kidding?
Well, and I want to get to December 7th, but I guess it's also important to point out you had enlisted and there was a time period that you were expecting to stay in the service. When were you thinking, hey, I'm going to be out of uniform and go back to civilian life?
I enlisted in 1939, and when you enlisted in those days, you enlisted for 3 years. And if you asked for duty overseas, you only had to serve 2 years overseas. Come home and you could take a discharge, or you could re-enlist and then continue on with your service. So I never really had that choice.
You would have been out in May of 42 had December 7th not happened, but December 7th did happen. What kinds of things were you doing at Hickam Field before that happened? And can you explain for everybody listening who maybe has never been there or doesn't know the layout, where Hickam Field is and what its importance was at the time?
It's right next to Pearl Harbor. Hickam Field and Pearl Harbor share the same banks of Pearl Harbor, if you want to look at it that way. As a matter of fact, the Officers Club at Hickam Field sits right on, I call it a peninsula. It's just at the entrance of Pearl Harbor where all the ships come in. And there's the Officers Club in Hickam Field sitting there. One side of it, you can see Pearl Harbor. Then if you look west, you see the Pacific Ocean. It's right there. And it's a beautiful location. It's a beautiful place.
So before December 7th, you're assigned to Hickam Field. What kinds of duties did you have? What was the work you were doing day to day?
I was a truck driver, but there was a situation came up, an opportunity for me to make a few extra bucks. And that was, if I would go in and do all the KP with a couple other guys, we would all get paid extra money. So on Sunday morning, December the 7th, that's what we were doing. My buddy and I, we were preparing the mess hall. As a matter of fact, we weren't serving food in the mess hall. We were redecorating, getting ready for Christmas. And we had an air compressor. We were going to spray paint the place. And we had a fellow in the carpenter shop. He made outlines of every state in the union of which we had a member from that state to honor them. We had a field stove that us guys that were working in the mess hall could have breakfast or lunch or whatever. So my buddy Alex says, well, listen, Ed, First Sergeant and all of his gang had to be in here last night, and they took food out of the walk-in refrigerator. They messed up every pot and pan in the place. We can't even make breakfast unless we clean up something. Now, you clean us a frying pan. I'll start the air compressor, and I'll light up the field stove, and we can have breakfast. I said, okay. So I'm back by the sink scrubbing out this frying pan. And Alex had started the air compressor. I heard it running. And then all of a sudden, I heard, boom. I looked around at that air compressor. What's wrong with that thing? I turned back around and continued scrubbing the pan. And another whoomp. And I looked at that thing, and then I heard the darndest explosion you'd ever want to hear in your life. Now I thought something blew up outside.
And of course, he would go outside to investigate. When we come back, we're going to find out what Ed saw, what happened next, and why he looks back at three incidents over the harrowing minutes that followed and believes that his life was spared. Find photos and a little video of Ed at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.